Well, I'm very delighted to be here. I walked around the conference, and this is different from any other conference I've ever been to. And I've been to more than my share in a wide variety of disciplines. Everybody seems competent, friendly, and enjoying life. And what more could you ask for? So my hat's off to you. As I walked around, I asked myself, okay, what could I contribute to this? I was very impressed with the amount of data, the intellectualism. I'm semi-retired, and I'm old, relatively speaking. So I bring to the party a framework. And frameworks and data need each other. Data without a framework doesn't go anyplace, and frameworks without data is just dreaming. So what I'm going to do today is to try to introduce you to my framework as yet another way of looking at things. I've been 50 years in the area of sound, hearing, cognition, perception, in a wide variety of disciplines, as you heard. About 10 years ago, MIT Press asked me to write this book, and I started the exercise and realized I didn't understand what sound was. And so this became actually a project with my colleague, who unfortunately is not here, Dr. Linda Salter, who actually also happens to be my wife for 40 years. So this was a joint project, synthesizing everything we knew about everything into a framework. And it was one of the most exciting intellectual periods because it became like a Sherlock Holmes exercise. And since I didn't belong to any institution and no discipline to own me, I could go wherever I want in my head, come up with whatever construct I want. And as the editor of MIT Press said to me, at this point, you can put anything in the book. We don't care. It's going to sell. Therefore, you can tell us about the moon is made of Swiss cheese and nobody will take it out. But that's another story. All right, so let's begin. Now, the framework, when I walked around the conference, I'm jumping to an end point. I was looking for what was missing in what I was hearing in the various presentations. And everybody was preoccupied with evidence-based assertions. And they're absolutely right. You can't make an assertion without some evidence to support it. But there's a flip side that goes with that. And if you don't snortle in your beer, it's called marketing. Coca-Cola does not sell Coca-Cola because they can prove to you with data as to why Coca-Cola is good for you. It's pure marketing. And many intellectuals don't like marketing. They don't know what it is. And if I had to recommend anything, which I'll get to at the end of the talk, you need a marketeer who knows how to package a message. And, you know, I may be good at what I am, you're good at what you do, but I suspect most of us, including me, aren't great marketeers. So that's the end message. So let's begin, and let's look at sound again. And if we look at it from a different perspective, and I mean really different, can we understand why people engage in sonically destructive behavior? They willingly blow their ears out. And you can say, it's stupid, it's not logical, it doesn't make sense, they should stop, you should warn them. But they do it. And so instead of looking at all the negativities that go with it, let's ask ourselves the question, why do they do it? And this introduces another discipline, which most of you probably don't have much experience with, and that is anthropology. And the original construct of anthropology after it moved into the 20th century is go live with the natives. You want to know what they do? You want to know how they think? You want to know why they do it? Go live with them. And it's a non-judgmental approach which replaced the preaching and conversion. So you don't go in and visit the natives with a message. You go in there and understand. So if you wanted to understand why 19-year-olds blow their ears out, you got to go live with them. I'm going to try to answer that question today. Okay, so let's start at the very beginning. What are your senses for? You know, you have eyes, ears, nose, whatever. What are they for? Why did evolution wire in all these senses? She didn't give you a magnetic sense. She didn't give you all kinds of other senses. But she gave you an auditory sense. She gave you eyes. What function does it serve? Not how does it work, not what sound about. And the answer in my framework is where it answers the question, where are you located and how do you think and feel about where you're located? And to borrow or to make up some new language, there are two elements of where you are. There's the objectscape, which these are made-up words, and that's the geometry and objects in your environment. And there's the eventscape of activities. And that's where you are. You know you're sitting in the chair because you can feel the pressure of the cushion against your rear. You know what the space looks like because you can see the walls. And you can hear all the events taking place. You can hear my voice beating you up. You can hear the silverware at the neighboring table. You can hear people chatting. You may be able to hear a kid crying in the background. Kids are well behaved that are here. This is your connection to the world. Now you may say, well, that's very nice, and we're going to get to why it's more than nice. And you know, evolution didn't do all this for no good reason. Most of you probably are not familiar with the sensory deprivation literature of the 1950s. I happen to have had a colleague who was part of that and soon passed away. It's a fascinating little booklet that describes the experience. What happens in the left if you put somebody into a suit where they can't touch, they can't feel, they can't smell, they can't hear, they have no sense of anything, and you float them in this tank? And the answer is, it's not good. And it's not good very fast. What happens is within 15, 20 minutes, almost everybody, these were students, and I think it was McGill, who volunteered for this experiment. They didn't know it was politically incorrect, and there weren't the politically correct policemen to tell them that. They started hallucinating. And after about 45 minutes, some of them had psychiatric episodes. They literally started flipping their cookies. And they eventually stopped the experiments, and some percentage of the ones that had psychotic breaks in the tank never recovered. Okay, your sensory connection to the world is not simply for comfort. Your brain doesn't work if you're cut off from the world. And on the right, I have a little picture of a less intense version of that. And it's still floating around today. And it is relevant to the work that the people in this society do. Sensory deprivation is really, really an intense experience. And even though this girl is doing it voluntarily, it's not to be trifled with. But like all elements like this, when I did an internet search on sensory deprivation looking for supporting material, to my horror and surprise, what I found is there are now people selling sensory deprivation tanks as a legal version of drugs. So the sensory world is not to be trifled with. Okay, the senses determine your location, and there are all different aspects of where you are. And the senses sound like have different properties. This area of coverage is how long do they last? Do they convey time? They're basically a transport mechanism. So sound is transport. If I ask you, what are you hearing now, you'll describe it as events. I hear the silverware. I hear, you know, I'll do this. And I'll say, what did you hear? And you'll describe, you heard my ring banging on the wood. And I said, no, don't tell me what caused the sound. Tell me what the sound, describe the sound. And whether you're a musician or an audio engineer, or no matter how long you've been in this business, you can't do it. You can't describe the sound, and I can make sound. You can describe things in a way that somebody who's heard that sound will associate to it. You can use language for shared experiences, but you have no connection in your brain between your language center and sound. So the idea of preoccupation with sound really sidesteps the issue. You're not designed for it. You're designed to function with the relevance of sound, and that is, it's for a purpose. And in fact, sound is really an event because there's no such thing as a static sound. You never get sound just sitting there. You need energy. Energy gets converted into something which becomes sound, whether it's an explosion or a chemical reaction. But try imagining a world with no energy producing sound. It can't be done. Vision is different because vision, we get the energy from the sun, and we as species rattling around the earth don't have to deal with that as a transport mechanism. It just is. And vision and sound have dramatically different purposes, which the ear and evolution really took into account. So sound is part of the sensory system, but it has particular... Let's see. Okay. Now, let me jump to a different topic, and I'll come back to it. Where are you? And there's two aspects of this question that are in recent times, certainly the last half century. There's an inner space and an outer space. We used to think, and the historic literature says, the outer space, that is this room, is where you are. The last 10 years of cognitive science research really are blurring this distinction between inner space and outer space, and you actually have a choice of where to focus. And a lot of the inner space concepts have received a lot of bad press. And in fact, there's a phrase that floats around, not so much now, but has altered state of consciousness, which is the Timothy Leary extension. But they never ask the inverse question. What's a normal state of consciousness? Which one of you is normal such that if somebody else was different from what you were doing in your head, you would say they're abnormal? And in fact, everything you do changes your consciousness. And there was a study in Northeastern University where music changes your consciousness. There are extreme versions of consciousness which are trance-like, you know, meditative states. Sensory inputs changes your brain. It rewires you. You are not a static animal. And in fact, again, using the imaging, the fMRI and so forth, if I'm successful in this talk, every one of you will walk out with a slightly different wired brain. And to the extent that that happens, your consciousness has changed. I have changed your consciousness. So why go back? What's a normal state of consciousness? So the internal and external worlds fuse. And again, the neuro research not only says it's fused, but the same brain substrates are working for both. So our conventional wisdom as what we are as people really isn't true. The intensity of a sound or a stimuli can act to deaden pain, suppress other sensory inputs. You don't get the choice. You get some choices, but this wiring came long before you and I stood up here. And in fact, the whole auditory system, if you ask somebody, what's your ears for? They'll tell you, understanding language and music. But our auditory system is built on species, that other mammals that came long before us. It's virtually the same system, tweaked and modified to handle speech and music. But the animals didn't get an auditory system. We just built on it. So why did nature give all these species an auditory system using a precious brain resources in their head, which are very sparse, high energy consumers? She did it for a reason. It has survival value. Okay, the inner space, and I just clipped this from the internet. These kids are looking at music. So going back to why did people blow their ears out? And in fact, music is a stimulus, like everything else. The tea on the table is a stimulus. And the left-hand slide really shows you the association in this tribal group, and we're all tribes, really does the symbolic association of music and drugs. And this is not a subtle picture. This, in the center, they're telling you that music, loud sound, is part of the high experience, it's part of the inner consciousness, it's part of the altered states, which we're all part of. And on the right, you say, where is this young woman with the headphones on? Where is she located? Is she in her inner space or her outer space, or a bit of both? And it makes a difference if you want to understand what's going on in those headphones as to why she's where she is. Okay, so let's just run through quickly. I am going to run out of time, which I always do. There's a whole discipline out there. But the book really uncovered so many disciplines that I never knew existed and their relevance. There is a fringe piece of anthropology called sensory anthropology. Not what your senses are from a biologic point of view. What's the purpose of them? And what the first thing that comes out, they're culturally relative. The biologic imperative doesn't exist with your senses. And so if I ask you in a functional way, what's sound? How does it function? Not how does it go into your ear, not what happens when you blow out your inner ears, but what's the function of it? You find yourself struggling. There are people who've worked on this subject, and I'm going to, the third element in here, there's a culture that got studied extensively, and if you ask them how many senses do they have, they say two. And you'd be surprised at what their two senses are. The two senses are vision, so we don't walk off a cliff or into a tree, and experiencing life. So everything else in their conscious sense of connection is experiencing life. Vision is a minor part and always had been historically until Gutenberg did the printing press and we got into modern culture. But evolution was only interested in you're not walking off a cliff. But the survival came from sound. You know, the snake walking, slithering through the grass or some other minor sound. That's what the system was for. It was the hearing what was happening in your environment. As a modern animal, we have some choices as to which sensory system we're going to function on. And cultural relativism says, I can use my senses for anything I want, and I can totally ignore them as we see fit. And so you see the role of the senses for language among the modern generation. You know, my son, who's 22, spends more time text messaging than talking to somebody. So the role of language, of speech, is changing. And rather than saying, oh, that's terrible, he's simply part of a thousand-year-old tradition of each generation uses their senses for what they want. Rather than talking about it, go visit them and find out how they think, what they do, and why. Going back to sound, it's unique. Among all the transport mechanism of events, it flows around obstacles, it goes into openings, it goes where it wants. It can reveal the interior of various objects. If I knock on this wood, you can get a sense of how it's made. It requires energy to create. And so you really get a sense of what created the sound, and in particular when the creation process disappears. You know, a mother will suddenly wake up in the middle of the night when she stops hearing her child. Okay, the absence of sound is as much information as the presence of it. And she can wake up because it is wired so deep. And again, the cognitive neuroscientists are showing you how this stuff gets wired in. So yes, it comes in your inner ear, it goes up, it makes its way to the thalamus, and then to the auditory cortex. But guess what? It takes a whole bunch of branches elsewhere, completely skipping the auditory cortex, and doing all kinds of things. And there's one piece of it that simply wakes you up. Another piece that handles arousal. I mean, these are really complex systems, and consciousness is the least interesting part of the system. Okay, I got to run out of time. I assume I'm not boring anybody with this. Okay, sound can radiate over large distances, so it's a remote transport system. It doesn't respect private property. It goes where it wants, and it's a broadcast system. It's an event broadcaster. Okay. Now, having established the properties of sound, we can say, what's hearing? What are its properties? It was not for speech and music because it was built on much similar systems long before speech and music. It was optimized for survival, and if you look at some of the evolutionary literature, even if you don't believe it all, it's clear that your brain is a very expensive experiment that evolution did. It's unbelievably expensive in so many different ways, but it proved to be successful because of its interesting properties. And its logical prefrontal cortex was only one small part of this experiment. There were massive other pieces of the experimentation. You really do yourself a disservice at not being aware that this exists. Echolocation. I don't know if you've heard the phrase. It's some people, especially certain blind people, can navigate around the space and not bump into things. They can literally visualize, notice it's a visual world, word, the space that they're in. The movie Ray Charles, I don't know if you saw it. If you did, you'll notice he never used a seeing eye dog or a cane. He had taught himself to visualize the world. To some extent, we all do this. We don't specialize in it. You are how you live. If you really wanted to get good at it, you could get very good at it. But even without getting good at it, you can hear an open doorway. You rely on this. If the lights go out, you really need to depend on it. And it's pre-conscious. It's not that you can sit there and say, oh, I hear it, unless you train yourself. But you do. And if you have loud noise in your house, you're more likely to trip because you can't hear the sound of your footsteps on whatever you're walking. These are real phenomena, but they're pre-conscious. It's not an intellectual situation. Okay, another really important part of hearing is it tells the eyes where to look. The eyes are pretty dumb. So you drop a plate over there, I'm going to go look at what just happened. But I'm not going to be scanning, looking all over. So the eyes are almost useless, and they never were intended to be early warning systems. The ears do that for you. And here's the kicker for the modern culture. You have no earlids. Nature said, you know what? I'm not going to give these nice little human babies a chance to shut out sound. It's too important for their survival. I'm going to wire it in deep into their midbrain or lower, and I'm not going to give them the chance to turn it off because they need it on 24/7, and I can't depend on their thinking about what they want to hear. Now, I'm going to jump to the end of the talk and we'll come back to it. Modern man says, well, everything we do in our modern culture takes advantage of artifacts of the human condition that we discover. Well, guess what group discovered that property of no earlids? Advertisers. Okay, and it's not just advertisers, anybody who wants to deliver a message. Try shutting out my talk. Try not hearing what I'm saying to you right now. This is an exercise. You're going to have to work very, very hard at doing this because it's coupling in tight. And we're going to get to some of the issues of why the kids blow their ears out. And it really relates to this no earlids. It gives you an emotional connection to people. It's a high-speed broadcast. To go watch your action movie next time you're home, turn the sound off. The movie disappears. Movies are made by Foley artists who understand that sound conveys everything that's relevant that's happening. Okay, hearing serves a function. I am going to really run out of time. I've got a four-hour talk, which I got to speak rapidly. Okay, we've done most of this. Functional deafness. That means your hearing works, but you can't hear what's going on around you. And this is a concept which has positives and negatives and really has to be understood. I'm going to start racing through. Historically, none of what I was talking about was relevant because there were no alternative choices. You exist in some, you know, English city. Your senses work. You couldn't control where you are. You are where you are. Definition of an eventscape. An event is a natural or intentional accidental conversion of mechanical energy, could be chemical, into sound, which is then broadcast to the inhabitants of a space. That's what you hear. An eventscape is a composite of all those temporal and spatial distribution of dynamic events. The soundscape is an event, and I am going to jump because I want to save the good stuff. Okay, so you got all these sounds in your eventscape. There's a language based on events. You're embedded in it. These events command your attention. They give space its identity. Okay, so now we're beginning to get one answer to half of the questions. Where are you located now? You are sitting in you're embedded in a social and physical world composed of static objects. That wall is moving, and dynamic activities, me with broadcasting emotional impact statements. So it's not what I'm saying. Because it's not your intellectual piece that's here. I'm doing a whole bunch of other event broadcasts. So I'm an emotional event broadcaster. I'm broadcasting pieces of what's in my head to you. How do you know where you are? By hearing events and objects. Now you take the lack of earlids and this competition for headspace and who's going to own you, and now you can say, where do you want to be? And the answer for most of the young people and most of us who have the ability, we don't want to be where we are. We don't want to be sitting watching this teacher lecture at us. We don't want to be sitting in an airplane. We just don't want to be where we are. But you can't get out. Let's skip. This is too much from the book. Okay, so I'm going to jump around. You don't mind, do you? Okay. So, what we now have is modern technology that was intended to be recreational for fun took on a new meaning. It was for transporting the listener. So your portable music player is a space transporter. And that's part of this quality of why they're not just listening to music. They're getting out of the space where they are. And if the environmental noise is loud, the only way they can spatially transport themselves is to make the headphone sound even louder. So they're not intellectuals. They're not thinking it through either in terms of why they do it, how they do it, or what the consequences is. They just know they don't want to be here. And they've gotten used to transporting themselves at will. And that's part of the answer to why they blow their ears out. They're not intending to. They want to escape. They want control. You get overlaid eventscapes where you can put yourself where you want. Here's this, young kid with headphones on. She's not in the space of doing her homework. She becomes functionally deaf to her mother yelling at her. She's taken herself out of the space. Because if her mother yells at her, she can't shut it out by closing her ears. If her mother holds up a sign, time to do your homework, she just looks away. But how does she get her mother? She doesn't. So now what you see is there's a democratization taking place. Everybody has control of where they are. And that's part of getting out of the sense of helplessness. Okay, does anybody know the literature that's fragmentary, that loud sound has been shown for some small percentage of people to have all the properties of addiction, including withdrawal? There was a small study done in Northeastern University. It hasn't been extended. So part of this thing is an addiction. Now, if you go look at the addiction literature by those who really know, there's a common theme that describes all addictions, whether it's shopping, loud music, sex, baseball, poker, it doesn't matter what it is. The common theme under it, when you go to the psychiatric, those that understand the psychiatric foundation, it's trying to handle the sense of helplessness. And if you email me, I'll give you a book. It's by Dodes, D-O-D-E-S, called The Heart of Addiction. He only talks about the classical addictions, you know, drug, alcohol, and so forth. But it's just as relevant for the music stuff. It's just as relevant for blowing your ears out. The sense of helplessness under the surface is what drives these systems. And if you do it long enough, you start rewiring your brain. So just as I'm rewiring your brain, these kids are rewiring it. They don't want to have the brains wired by the adults who created this predatory environment. Okay, so let's go now to why they make loud sounds. I'm not judging it. See, I'm not saying they should or shouldn't do it. This is sort of the anthro tradition of why do the natives do what they want. So the first step is they want to suppress events that they don't want to hear. They want to transport themselves to a new event escape. They want an altered state of consciousness. They don't want to be in the outer space that you plunk them in. They want to be in some place where they can control the space. They want to have overlaid eventscapes. They want to be partially in one or the other. And ultimately, you come back to the negative side of human nature. It's a commercial combat and control. Who owns you? Well, every advertiser in the universe wants to own you. And if you read the advertising literature, you see the chaos in that literature because the traditional ways of getting to headspace have been broken. They no longer can get to you. And so they're looking for every new means of doing it. And I'll give you one example. There's a new technology which is based on ultrasonic nonlinearities which can create a narrow focus beam of sound such that if I had this loudspeaker, I could aim it at one member of the audience and talk to that one person, nobody else could hear it. And it's being marketed to the vending machine manufacturers who now want to build in tracking devices. So as you walk down the aisle, it'll track you and say, oh, my recognition system says you're female and 5'2". I will then deliver this message to you as long as you're in the radius. This is not sci-fi. They haven't merchandised it yet, but this is where we're going. Everybody wants to own everybody else for their own purposes. So the blowing out of your hearing is really part of this larger combat. Okay, now how do you address all these issues? Suppose you've believed everything I say, and again, you know, I'm an independent scholar who can make up frameworks with no data to support it, so don't ask me how I can prove any of this stuff. So my job, starting with the book, was to go around to all these disciplines, you know, like a used bookstore, shop for all these unused bricks, take them home with me, and build this gigantic edifice. Maybe it's useful, maybe you believe it's true, but it's a creation. So how would you use this? And I thought about this and it sort of combines the workshop I did yesterday. Suppose you wanted to get at the generation that's blowing their ears out with loud, voluntary, dumb behavior. How would you get to them? And this is moving from the anthro, you know, visit the natives, to how would you change them? And the universal rule of changing people is not to talk at them and to explain logically. And in fact, there's a business school study, I can't remember it, where they took people's belief systems and they then presented massive evidence why their beliefs were not true. And contrary to everybody's expectation, it not only didn't change their minds, it solidified the negative belief systems. In other words, if I believed the moon was made of green cheese and you proved it wasn't, I knew it was made of green cheese. And so the notion that because we in this room probably have above average IQs, and we certainly have more knowledge, that knowledge trumps the other parts of your head is simply not true. Therefore, where does this leave us? So if you can make your case to your managers and a few other people about evidence-based, but that's not the language of the rest of the culture. And to use that language is just to ignore reality. What's the universal language? The universal language is empathy. I know how you feel. I can understand your sense of helplessness. I can share your pain. And believe it or not, again, back to the neuro, there's a whole class of neural activities that were discovered in Italy by accident called the mirror neurons, which they now think is just a subset of this mentalizing system. So the human connection is actually wired into your brain in a way that's really rich and textured. You want to connect to somebody, you got to connect to their brain piece that connects to you and vice versa. You can send messages if the connection is there. No connection, you're just wasting your time. And I consider myself very smart, very intellectual. But let me tell you, the intellect is a minor piece of influencing behavior. Don't do it. You know, my wife is also very smart. And when we try using logic, it doesn't go anywhere. What you're really doing is trying to get somebody to experience something differently. Because logic doesn't rewire your brain. Experience is rewired. And oddly enough, my talk right now is actually coupling back to the workshop I did yesterday. And for those that were there, will recognize the connection. You have to acknowledge for people that loud music has rewards. They wouldn't do it if there wasn't a reward system. So you can say to somebody, and this is where I get to the marketing, these are the messages that a professional marketeer has to deliver. Look, I really know you don't like being in that space, and I know how much you'd really like to escape. Let's work together on how you can transport yourself. And you don't say without blowing your ears out, because one of the things Marketing 101 will tell you never mention the negatives. That may drive your motivation. And I doubt whether there's more than one or two people in here who've taken some serious marketing training. And I think you're making a mistake. But then again, what do I know? I know from my own career, I didn't know what the word meant for the first 25 years. And later on, a couple of colleagues really taught me a little bit of what I know. And I think they're absolutely right. It's got bad press. But we all have to be in the marketing, image-building business. It's not intrinsically a negative, even though it's used for that. You want to get some traction? Go get a brand image in the public space and don't use logic. You need the logic to support what you're doing, but nobody's going to buy it. And you got to debate the positives and negatives. You got to have an honest dialogue with people. And don't undermine the negatives. And the last one is really an important one. Most of the preach equality when you tell somebody what to do without your realizing it really taps in to helplessness. And one of the things I also study is the negative baggage on ordinary words. And most of you probably wouldn't believe the word learning deep in your head has a lot of negative baggage. And unless you really start understanding the negative baggage, you're going to be surprised at the outcomes. Just to give you a peek, the associations for learning tap into all your early learning experiences. A big teacher telling you what you had to learn, a parent telling you to make your bed, and this whole subterranean system is still in your head. And even though you may not remember it, when I say, I'll teach you something, your head says, whoa, that's the helpless state where somebody's going to force feed me something. I ain't going there. And so a lot of the kids drop out of school simply because they're tired of being in that helpless state. They want to get to the self-agency. You know, you've heard of the phrase self-esteem. Most of you probably haven't heard of the concept of self-agency, which is a mirror image. You want somebody to feel good about themselves, but you also have to give them the sense that they're empowered to influence their environment, the world around them. That is not, you know, self-esteem. That is self-agency. So as you approach people, keep that distinction in mind. Logic has little influence. We dealt with that. Loudness is an addiction. I've already mentioned that. Conclusion and summary, destructive loud music is about who owns the experience of space and place, and loudness compensates for our lack of earlids and spatial focus. And I guess I'm done enough to take questions since I left myself 7 or 8 minutes. Well, somebody take a pot shot at me because I've already set myself to be shot at. Nobody? Anybody? What's your state of mind? I mean, I know what's going on. Just a couple to the thing I did yesterday at the workshop. You're broadcasting your emotions, and you know that's what the job is to read. So if you're going to deliver a message, make sure you recognize the broadcast. And I'm not going to do it here because this is not yesterday's workshop. But this is the art of delivering messages. And if you don't invest in this skill set, some of you do it intuitively. And some of you applause will be good at it. But everybody can become better at it. And I learned it late in life. So if I did learn it this late in life, you guys can certainly learn it and become better at it.
You're taking all the fun out of parents.
Let me tell you, it's still a lot of fun. I've got grandkids now, and that's like starting all over again. Somebody else? How many of you believe the picture I'm painting, even though I made it up? Yeah, okay. Okay, so I got some. Yeah, go ahead.
Can you comment on shared experience?
Yeah, the shared experience is really the central issue. Because all communications, one way or another, references shared experiences. You're not actually describing your experiences, you're referencing a sharing. And if you're trying to share an experience that somebody else had never had anything like it, you can't do it. And it gets carried to the extreme. You know, I'm talking to one of my colleagues and says, you know, that space sounds just like the 14th row on the left side of Boston Symphony Hall. And I said, yeah, it really does. You know, I can hear that, the similarity. Well, if I hadn't been in that seat, in fact, this is made up because there was another colleague who did, you can't communicate without shared experiences. And if you look at language, most of your natural language are metaphors. They're not real. And if you look, you don't have a dictionary in your head. You have a bunch of experiences. And the words you use link to these experiences. And one of the lovely experiments I do is I show you if you don't have shared experiences, you get complete misunderstanding and you don't know. Try the experiment of doing a test as to what the word trust means. And you'd be shocked at the variety of meanings you get. And yet you look at a dictionary and you think you got a stable meaning. Well, dictionaries are written after the fact. They're not the definition of the word. They're what somebody thought people meant when they used it some of the time in some culture and some context. But we don't have... And the simple words like, you know, I defended my position. Look at that as a metaphor. It's a battle metaphor. You know, I feel up this morning or I'm down. Why up is feeling a certain way and down another? And you can go through the language, word by word, sentence by sentence, and say, what's the intrinsic meaning? And the answer is not a lot. It's all metaphorical, image building, associations. You want to get your message across to people outside this room. You guys have shared experiences. You can talk shorthand, but there's not a lot of intrinsic information in your shorthand. Because if you're trying to teach somebody who doesn't have the experience, they're not going to relate to it. It's not going to. Yeah.
Does your framework then assume that fear as a motivating force is really not a very powerful one to be successful?
It's a very powerful one, but not to be successful.
What was the question?
He asked me, is fear... Say it again.
I'm not trying to remember it.
Basically, fear is a strong negative force that doesn't really work. It is a strong emotion. In fact, they know from 27 different perspectives, fear is probably the major, strongest emotion. And as a sidebar, the word emotion itself doesn't have a clear meaning until you look at it. The problem is there's another whole system which hasn't been studied as much, and that is the pleasure system. The fear system had to come first. Because you didn't worry about whether you were enjoying dinner or the friends around the campfire when the lion was about to eat you. So the whole fear system comes first. But it's not necessarily the driving system except to run away. So the old fear is the fight, flight, or freeze to keep yourself from being lunch. Kicks in immediately. But it doesn't change your perspective. It doesn't create an experience other than you escape, and you do it preconsciously. How do you know there was a lion there? Because you see your feet running away. It's not that you process the lionness and then decide to run away. And in fact, the whole emotional system is equally backwards. How do you know what you feel? Because your emotional messengers from the brain and the amygdala and all that send it down to your stomach, shut down the blood supply, get the heart rate up, do all these things, and another piece of your body says, gee, my stomach's tight, my muscles are tight, my heart rate's up, I must be afraid. But there's no direct connection in your brain that tells you you're afraid and what you feel. So these feeling systems were not really meant for your logical well-being. The pleasure system, which is where you get into the modern version of all the drugs and all the other behaviors and so forth, is not as strong, but potentially more compelling. And so you really want to tap into the dopamine system and all these other systems, you know, just like the drug advertising. And the marketeers who really understand this stuff do it. And if you go back to the famous artists and literary people over the centuries, they were really cognitive scientists. They couldn't tell you why they did it, but they really understood how to have impact, how to mess with your brain. And they did an exquisite job, whether they were musicians, whether it was, you know, art, visual artists, Da Vinci. These guys were early cognitive scientists, and they were good at it. Now what's happening is the real cognitive science are taking a look at people under these, you know, fMRI and PET scans, all these systems, and they're even combining Eastern and Western, you know, the meditation tradition with the scanning stuff, and there's a lot that they're learning. It's just a little difficult to access, and that's my job. Yeah. Well, a substitute reward, but really what I think, this is my own belief system, the reason this loud music has become so ubiquitous is there's a predatory quality to our culture which is very subtle. And the manipulation, whether you're studying the marketing behavior on Google or not, everybody wants to own everybody. It's not a whole lot different than 5 centuries ago. And to say we're civilized and we've outgrown that, I just don't think it's true. And so they really want an alternative way of feeling good about themselves in a meaningful way without the intellect to understand it. And so if you want to get to these people, you got to sell them a feel-good. That's my argument. And I've never, nobody's tried it. And I wouldn't try to deliver this message to the kids. I would try to, I'd go out and get the marketeers from Coca-Cola and says, look, this is what we want. This is the message we want to deliver. Give us your skill in packaging it and forget our intellect, which is our comfort zone and our data collection. Just tell us how to do it. Do we have time for one more? I'll be around so you guys can grab me. Or I don't know. Should we throw them out or let them keep going? Or what do you want to do?
We'll take one more question, then we just have 10 minutes until we reconvene in the breakout session. Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Somebody? Yeah, go ahead.
You're talking about the importance of language. How does it resonate when you say things like hearing conservation? Is that
totally arcane? First of all, too many syllables in the word. Secondly, you're presuming that the word conservation is intelligible unless you've been in it. I had to think for a minute the first time I was exposed to that phrase. I figured it out. I'm smart. But go out on the streets of Phoenix and do an anthropologic study. Say, excuse me for a minute. Would you just mind telling me what this means? And I dare say you get less than 2% recognition. Why then would you use something which has no experiential resonance? Why would you do that? Not if you want to communicate. Or at least, I'm not a marketeer, but maybe in this room I know something about marketing. I wouldn't take that approach. So I'll just leave one more question.
In that context of hearing and language, talk about a lot.
Talk about hearing and language?
In the context of hearing and language, talk about lying, not telling the truth.
Nobody cares about whether you're lying or not. It's all about human connection. And the issue of whether it's truth or not, who really cares about truth? Okay. When you go home, think about looking your spouse in the eye and say, do I really want her to be true about everything she's thinking and feeling and ever has? Do you want her to be true? How many believe in truth? Or is it selective truth? Do you really want truth? And there's some dumb, bad science fictions which play with that premise. I don't think you want truth. You want selective truth that achieves your emotional, personal agenda. But real truth? I mean, you want real... I mean, if I were giving you real truth, you'd throw me out of here. What did I choose to do? I chose to take selective truth to try to package it in a language I thought you would understand. I built a model of what I think you are by wandering around, visiting the natives, talking to you as individuals. The model's not perfect. I built the model and said, you know what? I'm going to modify the talk, not the slides, so that I think I can communicate to you in your language with your mental model. But it's not truth. It's simply a packaging exercise. So now let me ask you, how many people really believe in truth? Notice the hand quantities is smaller by a significant percentage. And marketeers will tell you, nobody ever sells truth. Coca-Cola, get up. Here's a product that costs us 2 cents to make. It has no value to you. It makes money for us. It's basically sugared water with this magic formula that we've taught you to become accustomed to. And we did it through creating habits and other reasons. Originally, it was cocaine. And that's truth. Would you think they were going to market Coca-Cola that way? It's sex. Drink Coke and go to bed with this whatever. Or you want to look like that actor, drive this automobile. I mean, what are you selling? You're not selling, you know, the horsepower of the engine and the braking and the miles per gallon. Why did Toyota Prius get successful? It had nothing to do with the gas mileage. And they only found that out by accident, because even the marketeers aren't so smart. What they discovered is there are people who are proud of being green, and it was a political, emotional statement about their internal identity. And the Prius had a unique shape, so they knew if they drove around town, everybody would read the label. I'm special. I'm different. I'm politically correct. You had a car that looked like every other car that was the Prius structure, and nobody would know who you were. It was an identity statement. It wasn't truth. And Prius didn't understand that. They designed it aerodynamically and then discovered there's something else going on here. And that is, it was all image branding. And the people who are driving it are your highest educated elite. And they don't recognize they're making a statement. Because, in fact, ecologically, the Prius makes no sense. Not if you look at it from the big perspective. You want truth? It makes no sense if you take the entire energy activity and the carbon footprint from the very beginning of the process to the very end. It makes no sense. Doesn't stop people like me from owning one. I'm around, so you're allowed to corner me any place.